Well, hello there, web user. I'm Carmen Wong Ulrich, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of November 1st, 2013. So I'm the new host, but I'm definitely not new to this topic. I've known how the market works since I was 8 years old. Why? Because I wanted to bond with my dad. He had me fetching the Wall Street Journal every morning. Though we didn't have a lot of money to invest, the seed had been planted. And I kept learning as an editor at Money Magazine, writing books on money, hosting shows on TV, online, and now radio. But know this, that this show is really about you. Because a show about our money is a show about family, culture, and values. It's about the choices we make in life with our money and how we can get more out of those choices. Join us online at thenewmarketplacemoney.org. It's time to live money. So last week on the show, my colleague Adrian Hill spoke to two folks, very brave folks, Laura and Scott, who are keeping money secrets from their significant others. And we heard from so many of you about the interview. There were lots of comments on our Facebook page, on our website, and one listener wrote, quote, "Financial infidelity is no different than that other form of infidelity." So I wanted my own chance to chat with Laura and Scott and see where things stand right now and maybe to offer them just a little bit of friendly advice. Hi, Laura and Scott.
Hi, Carmen.
Hi, Carmen.
Hi. Oh, you're so brave to return.
We'll see how this goes.
It is a brave thing to kind of talk about these issues. Money is such a touchy topic when it comes to relationships. Laura, let's start with you. What kind of reaction did you get? How did you feel after that?
I was nervous because I thought, oh my goodness, what if my significant other hears this interview and they recognize my voice? I thought, well, I would have to come clean and then a whole new realm of possibilities would open up.
I have to ask you, even though you were nervous, do you feel like you shared your story because you just didn't want to keep it anymore?
Yeah, there was a sense of relief.
Scott, what about you? What was your own reaction and then any reaction you got from anyone else after the show?
I'm happy to share my story. I'm a pretty outgoing, sociable guy, so I don't mind talking about my situation. It doesn't bother me. Everybody's situation is different.
Right. And Scott, but there's only just one person that you're not maybe not that outgoing with, your significant other, about this one particular topic. So you're outgoing at times. Did it change at all the way you feel about keeping the secret?
Well, I don't like keeping secrets. I don't like having to have separate bank accounts. But after 5 years of marriage, you got to do what it takes to keep it going.
And I have to ask you both. It's tells a lot about a relationship and the types of secrets you keep. So, Laura, for you, this is a situation where you have assets that you're just don't want him to know about. And is some of that the whole you just don't want him to love you for your money?
You know, I don't think that would necessarily change anything. We've been together strong for 2 years, and I feel like we're on a forward momentum. I think it's more of that his family comes from a different, looking at money differently than, at least from what I have perceived, compared to what my family taught growing up.
Ah, what's different about it?
When he gets a tax return, he seems to, you know, really want a lot of things that he doesn't necessarily need, and he saves up that money and uses it. So it's like when he gets money, he spends it. And I think his family, his dad would get bonuses and they would spend it rather than save it. I think financially they used to be much better off, and now they seem to be not doing as well, and I'm worried that they don't even have savings. So I'm nervous because it's very different.
Well, you definitely have every right to be nervous too, because you have very different styles or personalities, money personalities. Mm-hmm. So, Scott, let me ask you, I mean, do you have financial goals that the two of you agree on?
I am totally goal oriented, and so is my wife, and we do save a lot. We both agree that we need to put money away for a retirement, for a college education. We have no debt. We both want to be able to grow our assets, and that's all baked into our family budget. I just need a little bit of discretionary spending just to have fun once in a while.
So this is money that you could afford to spend. It's just that you disagree on where the money should go or the value of your being able to keep your sanity I'll give you a little bit of advice on that end, because a lot of times we have these disagreements with our significant others because basically we give a different value to money. And some of it has to do with control, people. Like, we want to control things. But I do think that it's really sensible that if you guys are both your grown-ups, your goals are being met, that you make sure that you each have your own separate accounts. Because we need to feel autonomous. You need to feel like you don't want to have be nickeled and dimed by your significant other. So maybe approach her and say, you know what? I need to set aside $100 a month, whatever it is. This is my money. And I get to spend it this way. But look, all the other things are being taken care of. The bills, the retirement, the college, all that stuff. But I need this to feel relaxed, to feel better, and we can afford it. What would she say?
That's good advice. I've tried that approach in the past, and it always ends up highly emotional. My wife has a very strong reaction against that, throws out comments like, starts crying and says that I don't love her and I'm trying to take my money and run.
Oh, dear.
And we want to make sure that the family is taken care of and can do all the things that the family wants to do. I'm an individual, and yeah, I'm guilty. I like control. What man doesn't?
Well, I would say, what person doesn't, Scott? What person,
what person
doesn't?
What
because
person?
Right, because I would, sure. I would agree, and I think, Laura, you would agree with me, that I think that most people do want to have some autonomy and not report in.
Definitely.
No.
Oh, yes. If we ever are going to be married, I have no doubt that we'll be keeping our own accounts and having joint money in one and then have our separate stashes.
And Scott, I think I'm going to have you and the missus on to talk to her, because it is very emotional. And I have to ask you to kind of be curious about why she's having such an emotional reaction, because it's not as if you guys are drowning. So there's something else going on there that you want to kind of look into. It's getting at the root of that. It really will take this secret and release the power from it. Because right now it's got like a lot of power and tension in your relationship. And Laura, to your point about coming into a relationship with money, that is yours. So you do have the, you know, right, let's say, to not tell your significant other about it. But I would also say maybe you can kind of inch towards it by talking to him more about the spending issues. And just as you've revealed here, that say, look, your family's in some trouble. I think I want us to avoid that.
Yeah.
And this is how.
Yeah. Come at it from a place of concern rather than an accusation.
Laura, you just like gave everybody great advice. If you come at these money secrets from a place of concern, and Scott, if you say, listen, I'm really concerned about the fact that you get so upset. What is this really about? Laura and Scott, thank you so much for being brave today.
Thank you for having me on.
Thanks, Carmen. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, guys. And if you have a cash confession to share, get some relief, get that load off your back, go to marketplacemoney.org. You know, the most important lessons we learn about money don't necessarily come over these airwaves. They come from our parents. So this week, we start a series inviting someone that you probably know to tell us how parental advice shaped how they live money.
I am Tae Zonde. I sing, I act, I pursue voice work. I am best known for the work I do on YouTube. At the point I entered graduate school, I was thinking I would have a life as an academic. Then I uploaded Chocolate Rain.
Chocolate Rain. Some stay dry and others feel the pain.
One person can make something on YouTube and it can go viral and be replicated and covered and parodied by thousands of people, as happened with Chocolate Rain. The YouTube world is a different world than the world my parents grew up in. My parents were both school teachers, and then my mom was a school principal for 20 years. So I'd say that ethos of finding predictability in finances is something that I definitely inherited as an adult. You know, we were never poor as I was growing up. There was always some money around. We were never extremely wealthy either. You know, my dad is never prone to buying things on a whim, on an impulse. It's all very well considered, very well thought out. What is the benefit? What is the return on investment for whatever expenditure it is? That was always part of the subtext of whatever my parents both spent money on, whether it was a Christmas gift or a birthday gift. It wasn't just something that was frivolously purchased. It was an investment. And in them giving it to me or my siblings, you could kind of feel their hope. My dad got me an Alesis QS8 synthesizer for my 16th birthday. I mean, my dad was hoping that I could use that to become something, that with that instrument, that could contribute in some way to my development or being a happier, more fulfilled child. My parents' career choice as public servants now seems no more stable than pursuing a job in entertainment. I guess that's what work is now. It's not just, you know, getting a job, getting a 9-to-5. It's taking a holistic view and saying, how can I monetize my life?
Share what your parents taught you and what you're passing along in your family. Tweet us your money tips at HowWeLiveMoney. Coming up, when you're buried in debt and you can't dig out, how does it feel?
It's like, you know, when you get into bed and you pull the covers up and you pull the covers up right to your eyes and you just kind of look around and you think, I'm just going to go to sleep and I'm not going to look. You know? You kind of get like that.
Pull back those covers. Next on Marketplace Money from APM. This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Carmen Wong Ulrich.
Carmen, what's going on?
Yep, that's me. I want to know what's going on with your money. Talk to me at marketplacemoney.org. And joining us now is 30-year-old Amanda from Chicago. Now, usually when I get a 30-year-old asking me a question about money, it's all, how do I get out from under all this student loan debt? I can't save a dime. Well, not magical, Amanda. She not only has no debt, she has six figures in retirement savings and another six figures in cash. She's amazing. But Amanda was recently let go from a place where she's worked for a very long time. And now she's asking, well, can I just retire? That's right. You heard it. A 30-year-old is asking about retirement. But Amanda, I have to start by asking you, first, my question, how did you save that much money?
You know, I was fortunate that my family taught me the value of savings. And I started at a young age, and I knew when I forewent the choice to go to college or pursue higher education that I was taking a risk, and I wanted to insure myself when I took that risk. So I saved while I was working and fortunately amassed a good emergency fund.
And Amanda, you wrote in with this fabulous word that we so rarely hear, let alone with a 30-year-old, but you said you want to retire. What's up with that?
Yeah, I'm calling in today because I'm hoping you'll tell me that I'm ready to buy a boat and sail into the sunset.
At 30, though. Do you picture yourself, though, at 30? Is that what you're seeing, that you want to, you know, get that boat and sail off into the sunset until you're 80, 90?
I just want to know, like, when is enough enough? I feel like I was diligent and put away money while I was young and working, which I know is an equation maybe for success. But I want to know at what point is enough enough.
Well, and that's the thing, Amanda. You've saved so much. Do you know that you actually have more in savings and retirement savings than over three quarters of this country? Like, you are a member of the savings elite. And here's the thing, though. I have to ask you, because when people save, you have to answer this question. What are you saving for exactly?
My goal is always to work as hard as I could for as short as I could. And so I was saving with the idea that I had to work a job for as little as possible. And I don't know if I'm there yet, but that was my goal.
And, you know, most folks this day and age are really afraid of being laid off. It seems like you sound really happy.
I am. Yeah. I would say now is the happiest that I have ever been.
So you're like, wave the pink slip in the air like you don't care because you were happy.
I'm laughing all the way to the bank, right?
Well, that's brilliant because you also collected unemployment as well.
I did, yes.
Yeah, Amanda, so I recommend that you give yourself a little bit of a time limit. Do you know very clearly what you want to do in that one? Like, let's say if you give yourself that 1 year time frame, how does that look to you?
I wouldn't say that I necessarily know clearly. I would love to explore starting a blog or my own kind of food business. Am I 100% committed to that? And do I have right now the knowledge or wherewithal to do that? Not necessarily. So that's certainly the first opportunity that I would like to explore. And otherwise, I kind of hope that I have this light bulb moment where, you know, I have this time off and one day I'm kind of sitting around in the kitchen and it's like, oh, this is exactly what I want to do, and hopefully pursue maybe another aspect or opportunity in life.
Well, it's funny because the way you describe it, that maybe the light bulb will come, but that's very important to recognize. You know, a lot of folks don't realize that the light bulbs turn on. They don't do it by themselves. They do it because you're out there getting experience and doing things and figuring it out.
Right. Yeah, I need to kind of pursue other things while I have this time or meet other people that might open different doors for me.
Yeah, and I have one more piece of the puzzle that we all got to think about, and you need to think about if you want to. What about settling down? You have any thoughts there?
I mean, if you know someone and you want to introduce me, I'm totally.
Amanda, totally setting you up. I know some people in Chicago. Someone's got to deserve you, however, because you are in a very interesting financial situation. You have earned and saved and built yourself up a big bunch of assets at the age of 30. And so my question part of that is, do you ever think about that when you settle down with somebody or you, let's say, live with somebody or end up in a home with somebody, what are you going to do with that money? How do you see all that factor in?
I don't know. I think it would be kind of a turnoff for me if I was to meet someone that would not have kind of the same spending habits as I have. And not necessarily that they have to have built the same kind of things that I have, but to live a similar lifestyle, I think, would be attractive.
Oh, yeah, because you want to bond on budget, right?
Right, exactly, yeah. Budget love.
Budget bonding. Budget love. That's
yeah,
a good
exactly.
one. Not that you need a partner to feel whole, but the issues really here to think about. It sounds like you worked really, really hard, and now it's time for you to do what you want to do. And
yeah.
You definitely have set yourself up very well. But I tell you, you're only 30. The odds are you're going to live to about 84 as a woman, you know? So, wow, that's a lot of time. Is this enough to take you through? Absolutely not. But have you set yourself up on a good foundation and great habits that you could do what you want to do and make a little bit of money? Now, I would encourage you to not use the money that you have saved up beyond 1 year.
Okay.
Simply because, now, would your emergency fund that you have $35,000 in cash. Would that sustain you for the year?
Oh, yeah. Definitely 1 year, if not a little bit longer.
Oh, wow. Bravo. Bravo, Amanda. So that is okay because
okay.
You don't want to exhaust those funds. You want to be able to continue to have that freedom. The longer and the more you can kind of get some income coming in, whether it's a part-time job or you start making money on the site, you know, that is going to be able to keep you in that lifestyle. But if you want to give yourself, and I recommend you give yourself a time limit, and say, when my balance gets to blank or when a year has passed, then I'm going to have to kick myself. If I don't have enough money coming in, I'll have to go back to work somehow. But just be okay with plan B. Are you okay with plan B, which is going back to work?
Yeah, absolutely. I am. In whatever capacity. Again, if it's part-time, if it's a small amount of income, or if it's a second career, great.
That's fantastic. And it sounds like you're really realistic about what could happen.
I hope so.
Amanda, I now crown you Marketplace Money's first unicorn. You are a fantastical creature who actually exists. Amanda from Chicago, 30 years old, with six figures saved away. Thank you so much for joining us, Amanda.
Thank you. I appreciate it very much.
So do you want to retire early? You can read more about what to consider online at marketplacemoney.org and follow and tweet us at How We Live Money. Share your thoughts, comments, and especially your questions. Another caller. Emily's on the line from Valdosta, Georgia. She and her husband do pretty well. He works full-time. She works part-time. But they have three daughters, ages 16, 13, and 9. And you know you see the dollar signs stacking up right there. But Emily's family is currently dealing with massive credit card debt. What's the bill? About $75,000. And some of those cards are at an interest rate as high as 29%. Emily, talk to us about this. How did you get here?
Well, it happened slowly, really. We've been married 20 years. It started out innocent, just buying things to decorate our new home with, and rugs and furniture and pictures, and it just slowly grew. And then there were children that we had and moves that we made and trips that we took and Christmases. And before we knew it, it was eating us alive.
And when you were accumulating this debt, let's say 5-10 years ago when you were still building up debt, when you got those bills, what did you and your husband say to each other in terms of paying those bills? Or what kind of conversation was there, or was there no conversation?
The conversations would sometimes be arguments, pretty heated arguments. You know, he'd say, you're charging too much, you're spending too much. And then I would say, well, you went to Lowe's and you went to the hardware store and got that, and it still is that some, even though we try not to use them anymore. There's a lot of negotiating and rationalizing and fighting and arguing, and then sometimes we would be saying, okay, we're, you know, supporting each other. We're going to figure out how to get through this, which is pretty much where we are now.
And even now, though, it's taking a much bigger toll on you than just financial, right?
Definitely.
What's going on with you? This is a lot of stress.
Well, I take antidepressants, of course, and that helps some. You know, there's a lot of just trying to hold the tears back each day and just really just, you know, try to focus on the good things.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one of the things about debt that can be so depressing is that it really leaves you with a feeling of lack of control. So it's as if now everything that you guys do has to kind of be around this circle of getting out from under, and you feel trapped. It's debt can trap you, right?
That's right. There were, I would say, 10 years out of our 20-year marriage where we just lost control over our finances and being realistic about, okay, this is how much we bring in, this is what our bills are, and this is what we have extra to spend. You know, we just spent
a good 10 years of our marriage not really looking at that.
And so let's talk about your daughters. I got one too, and I had a big family of girls. I love that you've got these three girls. But I have to ask you, you know, you said there's a lot of arguments, there's a lot of stress. What are you guys arguing about? If you are arguing now, what is it about?
Well, it's probably going to start soon, and that'll be Christmas.
Uh-huh.
How are we going to provide three daughters Christmas presents?
And what happened with the holidays last year?
Last year, we probably used the credit card to buy the larger things.
And did you both agree on that, or was there friction there too?
Well, you kind of, it's like, you know, when you get into bed and you pull the covers up, and you pull the covers up right to your eyes, and you just kind of look around and you think, I'm just going to go to sleep and I'm not going to look, you know? You kind of get like that. It's depressing. It's a hard cycle to break, and you want to break it, but...
So how much debt from last Christmas? Do you remember, like, your final tally?
I would say that I'm just guessing that most Christmases end up being about anywhere between $3,000 and $6,000, it seems like. That's debt.
Emily!
I know,
okay.
It's awful.
You have just put me in absolute cardiac arrest. I'm going to take on your Georgia. Oh, my word, Emily. That is tremendous. And because I was just about to say, you know, a third of Americans, and this is why there's so much personal finance stuff around the holidays, because anywhere from 28 to 30 plus percent of Americans end up carrying debt from the holidays. The usual amount is closer to several hundred to $1,000. But here's my question to you, because now I'm kind of in shock. What are you guys trying to do by spending that much on the girls?
Well, I mean, so it's not all on our children. There have been things that we have purchased for each other at Christmas time, maybe, that we wanted throughout the year. One such thing was a tennis ball machine. We bought a tennis ball machine because my husband and I both play tennis together. So that's how we relieve stress, is we almost always go to the tennis court in the evening after we fed them and play tennis. It just helps us.
You know, it's free. Like, throw the balls towards each other. That's totally free. And you could work out some frustrations along the way.
Absolutely, I agree. And listing that tennis ball machine on Craigslist is probably something I'm going to do when we get off the phone.
Excellent. That is a step in the right direction. You know, you guys, in your situation, the spending is really an issue. This isn't necessarily about, you know, debt because someone's been out of work or there's a medical issue. It is really tied to buying stuff. So what I would say to you and your husband is to take a really hard, strong look at why you feel this pressure to buy stuff rather than investing in the both of you and your daughters. So for example, $6,000 in the holidays. Imagine what that could pay for your daughter, the eldest one, to go to college. Like, that's a big investment that you can make as opposed to buying stuff. And are you and your husband ready to make a real commitment to understanding how the spending, it just ain't working for you?
Oh, yes. Very much so.
Part two of this is that there is help for you. I would love for you to sit, both of you, to sit down with a nonprofit credit counselor. Would you guys be willing to do that?
Absolutely.
Okay, so you can find a nonprofit credit counselor near you and folks listening anywhere across the country at nfcc.org, the National Foundation for Credit Counseling. Then make a big move. You guys are also in your 40s, and the biggest gift you can give to your daughters is to be financially stable yourselves so that your daughters don't have to take care of you.
That's right.
Emily, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, well, thank you.
Remember, Craigslist, tennis ball machine, right now. Thanks, Emily.
All right. Thank you. Have a nice day.
If you have a question that you'd like to share here at Marketplace Money, head over to marketplacemoney.org. Coming up, first comes love, then comes marriage, then the battles.
He goes out and buys the truck with the chrome package, and she's more interested in funding the retirement fund. You know, they've got kind of diametrically opposed views on what money is best used for. This is going to be a problem.
Contracts in marriage. Do they work? That's next on Marketplace Money from APM. Get up to speed on some hot money headlines.
Fire. Yeah, sizzle, sizzle, sizzle. Sizzle, 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 sizzle.
Next time you head into the skies, you won't have to power down.
Turn your electrical devices off as fast as you can.
However you do.
Don't make me ask you again.
Your in-flight team or the sign above will determine when electronics may or may not be used during flight.
This week, the FAA ruled that electronic devices can be used on airplanes throughout the flight. But I don't know if I'm happy about that, losing my 15 minutes of peace and quiet. But for you road warriors out there, something tells me your bosses are going to be happy.
Now they'll be able to sort of plan to do work or to plan to stay connected. People find that therapeutic to use their devices.
And how about a beverage to go with that tablet?
Can you believe that I spend as much money on wine as I do food?
I hear you, girl, but have you heard this? There's a global wine shortage, and I've been thrown into a depressed panic. A new report says we're suffering the largest undersupply of wine in 50 years. Consumption in the U.S. is up, also in China.
That interest in wine is growing. French wine still dominates the market, but that seems to also be changing. There's a lot of interest in new world wines from the United States and Australia.
So vino lovers, lean in for this hot tip. Make friends with your local wine shop and buy your wine in bulk, like paper towels. I get a 15% discount for a case at my place down the road. After all, we may like our wines full-bodied, just not full-priced. You can find more on these stories plus other money news at our website, marketplacemoney.org. So there was a great post recently on the Freakonomics blog, and it was written by a young man who was asking them for some important supporting data on marriage. He has a long-term girlfriend, and he also has a theory that entering into marriage should be like entering into an employment contract. Well, that's kind of interesting. So we've invited a couple of guests to talk that idea out. Emma Johnson is a writer, AM radio host, and author of the blog Wealthy Single Mommy. Hi, Emma.
Hi, thanks for having me, Carmen.
And Jeff Dew is assistant professor in the Department of Family, Consumer, and Human Development at Utah State University. Welcome, Jeff.
Thank you.
So, guys, this post just really caught me. Jeff, I want to start with you. What is the deal in terms of marriage being this kind of contract?
Yeah, well, certainly, you know, historically, marriage was, you know, kind of understood as this agreement between two people and sometimes between two families.
Now, Emma, you and I have been married, divorced. So this is not a prenuptial agreement he's talking about.
What's interesting about what he's written about and what I've been writing about over the last year is the idea of a renewable contract. So it's forcing you to revisit issues, whether it's money, whether it's sex or in-laws. It's revisiting these issues at a fixed amount of time. It's forcing communication, which is great for marriage.
And what I'm wondering about, Emma, is this idea of this contract or this possibility, this could be used to weed people out, right? Meaning if someone doesn't agree.
Right. It's forcing conversations, difficult conversations that you don't want to have when you're so wrapped up in picking out the perfect Vera Wang dress.
No way. I'm all about the DIY wedding, okay? But right, because I feel like that because, Emma, you seem to kind of think this is a good idea, right?
I think it's a great idea.
That whole process is in its own way. It's almost like, let's go back to the original part in the blog about the employment contract. Though the reason why I don't like it being called an employment contract, by the way, because that insinuates that there's a boss. Who's that boss, right? Anyway, my point is that having the conversations up front, just as if you were interviewing someone for a job, you weed out people.
That's right. If you are sitting down with the person you plan to spend the rest of your life with, even if you're renewing that those vows every 5 years or 20 years or whatever, you want to know these things about each other. But I think in something institutionalized that's universal that forces these discussions, probably with an expert. I mean, if it's a contract, you're probably sitting down with an expert lawyer who's making you talk through these things. I don't see what can come out of that. That's negative.
Well, but Jeff, how realistic is that in terms of the majority of people being on board with it? Because don't we still have this just real, this idea of this should all be about the love?
Yeah, I mean, I think some people would find, you know, kind of goes against this idea of romance and all that. And I think that's why you don't see, you know, a huge percentage of couples doing prenups. I think there's, you know, something that they find, you know, distasteful about that. So I definitely am on board with the idea of getting couples to talk. Now, whether it's with an expert lawyer or even, you know, with a relationship therapist, you know, I'm not sure that, you know, we all have the time or the money to do that. Society-wide, but, you know, I think it's definitely these conversations need to happen.
We can't afford to do it society-wide, but we're all getting divorced, and that's extremely expensive. Not
Good
just the process.
God, is it expensive.
So I don't think we can afford not to be addressing this issue on the front end.
But I do agree to the point that, you know, knowing how a lot of people are with their money, that they would kind of shy away from this. And, Jeff, you bring up a point about discussion, bringing the money issue into marriage, mm-hmm. and bringing that, you know, someone has a lot of debt or maybe someone has a lot of money and doesn't want to tell the other one. When you have a very kind of off-balance approach to money or, let's say, money baggage, how does that impact the possible success of marriage?
Couples really do need to be talking about how they handle money, their debt levels. They need to be, you know, talking about their financial goals together. These financial fights come out of just hitting an icy patch and getting, you know, problems with their money. Maybe someone loses a job and whatever. But, you know, other times couples are fighting about money because they haven't really talked about what they think money is best used for. And he goes out and buys the truck with the chrome package. And she's more interested in funding the retirement fund. You know, they've got kind of diametrically opposed views on what money is best used for. That's going to be a problem. I read something once where, you know, today's couples know more about each other maybe sexually than they do financially. And, you know, that's definitely a problem. They need to be talking before marriage and making sure that they're, you know, financially compatible.
Jeff, that's a shocking bit of information that you just left with me.
I think the most alarming statistic that I found in my research is that the percentage of Americans who are married today has halved in the last 40 years. So a lot of people will reject a prenup. A lot of people will reject the idea of their partners pressuring them to sign a contract because we're still tied to this Ozzie and Harriet model of marriage. That hasn't worked for a very long time.
There's no doubt things have changed. That's
they have
the thing
changed
with
so much.
The role of women and earning power and all of these things. So maybe it's not so much, and Jeff, you kind of came in on this too, that it's not so much marriage that's the problem. It's the expectations and how we go about getting married, that if that were to improve and incorporate now our new modern life, that maybe our chances for success would be much, much better. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Carmen.
Emma Johnson is the creator of the blog Wealthy Single Mommy, and Jeffrey Dew is an assistant professor of family, consumer, and human development at Utah State University. For a link to the blog post that prompted this conversation, visit marketplacemoney.org. This is Marketplace Money from APM.
Carmen, what's going on?
Let's get back to some listener questions. Penny now joins us from Santa Monica, California. Penny's 56. She works full time, and she's facing a really big decision: to buy or not to buy. That's the question, because home prices and mortgage rates are rising in many areas, leaving some first-time home buyers wondering, is this the right time? Welcome, Penny.
Hi.
Penny, why? I always ask folks when they're about to buy a home, why now?
Well, mainly last summer, my neighborhood got so noisy that I could barely stand it. And I kept complaining to friends about the noise. And finally, people were like, well, maybe this is a sign that you're supposed to move. And I started looking into buying a place and looking at some of these first-time home buyer grants that you can get from Los Angeles. But the areas that I was looking into, I realized were not going to be Santa Monica. So I actually ended up sort of giving it up for a while because I was really intimidated by the price of the homes that were in the area I wanted to live in were just so outrageous.
Yeah, but Penny, you mentioned a sign, that it was a sign. And it's interesting because a lot of folks, sometimes me included, we make decisions based on gut a little bit. But there are other things, there are other aspects to this home buying and history that you have that's really interesting.
My mother, we had moved to Arizona from Michigan, where we had sort of an idyllic life. And we moved to Arizona because I had lung problems, my mom had lung problems. And soon after we moved there, my dad died. So my mother was a widow in Arizona, and she had a problem with drinking. And so we lived in a lot of apartments that were not really good for kids. And then she got sober in AA, and during that time, part of the AA program is all about, you know, trying to live your life the way your higher power's will is. My mother made a real point of stressing that to us and using it kind of like as a teaching moment, and she had decided that we needed to live in someplace that was better for kids, and she ended up driving through this neighborhood that was a very middle-class neighborhood and just felt inspired to drive up the street, and she found a home there that was for sale by an owner, and it wasn't even listed anywhere, and she felt that it was a sign from God, and she bought the house. So it was a wonderful place to live. But unfortunately, my mother started having health problems. She did start drinking again. And during that time, all the people in the neighborhood were just wonderful to us. And if we had lived in any of those other apartments that we'd lived in before my mom got sober, I have no idea what would have happened to us.
Penny, what about, do you make any of your other financial decisions? I mean, where does faith fall in terms of your, you know, we each have kind of a mentality or a tradition or approach to personal finance that can be very tied, not just to the community and to our memories of our parents, but also to spirituality. So, for example, I was raised with tithing, you know, giving to the church a certain percentage of your income. How, for you, Penny, what else, you know, where else is that influence in terms of decisions you make with your money?
Well, you know, I was thinking about that, and a lot of the decisions that I've made, like when I decided to move from Arizona to Santa Barbara to go to photography school, I hated Arizona, and I really felt inspired that I needed to do something. And it was when I started thinking about moving to California and applying for photography school, it became the most effortless thing that I could have ever imagined. And that, I felt like I was completely aligned with what God wanted for me. And it ended up being a really amazing experience. They said that our class at that time was the nicest people they'd ever met. So I think with the bigger decisions in life, I'm really good at sort of listening to what God wants for me. But I would say that kind of my Achilles heel is that once I get there, sometimes planning for the little things, I'm not so open to that. You know, I'm a little bit more running the show myself rather than trying to figure out what God wants for me.
What do you feel is most important? Let's give me a 1, 2, 3 on buying that home. You know, community we know is very important. But what else? Because this is a commitment that you're going to stay put for a while.
Definitely. I would say, it's so funny because I love where I live now because there's a lot of places to walk. And then safety.
Now, at first you mentioned budget and you mentioned, you know, being able to afford what. Do you see this as kind of it's going to be a real give and take in terms of your commute, that you're going to have to spend more in terms of time and money on gas and all of that? What are you going to compromise so that you can get those top three things?
I probably will have to compromise commute.
And also, Penny, you know, you're actually close to retirement age at 56.
Right.
Yeah, because there is a cost to taking on a mortgage, especially a 30-year mortgage at the age of 56, when you're close to retirement, that you may not be able to realize and enjoy the full potential of, you know, being a homeowner.
Exactly.
Also, too, that commute, you know, and what would happen if you were to stay in that apartment until you retire, and then you could move to wherever you wanted. But it's a kind of a real toss-up. It's kind of the cost of the commute and your health and the stress versus owning that home. And that's something that you definitely can think about and weigh the alternatives.
Exactly. That's what my sister, who's brilliant, told me. She was like, Penny, you know, it costs a lot of money to buy a house. You know, why don't you just stay where you are until you retire? And, you know, everything she always tells me is always right. So I have.
Oh, I like her.
Yeah, she's very, very, very smart woman.
And I'm sure that you will pray on it. And then you will let me know where you decide and what you end up doing.
Absolutely. And, you know, it is interesting giving this, you know, really looking at it and even just talking with you now. It does make me really appreciate what I do have. Like,
yeah.
I am very fortunate to have this apartment in Santa Monica and to have a good job. And maybe this is what God's will is for me right now.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story, Penny.
Thank you. You've given me some things to think about.
Head over to marketplacemoney.org for more tips on how to avoid some common home buying mistakes. Great blog post this week by global recruiter Greg Savage called How Did It Get to Be Okay for People to Be Late to Everything? In it, he shares the most incredibly rude but probably very common people being late stories. Now, I'm a big believer that time is money. Consider this. How much do you make in an hour? How much more could you make if you had wasted time back? I bet you could probably learn another language, maybe get another hour of sleep, or maybe even read a book. But with the advent of being able to send a text and say, 5 minutes away, it seems to have given us a strange permission to make lateness acceptable, simply because we declare it. Now, I do realize that time is relative and very cultural. For example, making plans with my beloved brother, I always ask, Latin time or American time? Because Latin time in my family means at least half an hour late, and you're on time. So am I always on time? No. One doctor's appointment that starts 20 minutes late can throw off my whole day. But how about we make a pledge to respect each other's time? After all, some of us have babysitters at home, and you can bet that their meter is ticking. So you want to save some money? Me too. Be on time. I'm Carmen Wong Ulrich. Write to me at marketplacemoney.org. Follow and tweet at How We Live Money. I look forward to hearing from you. Marketplace Money is a family effort. The show is produced by Dan Gretsch, Nancy Fargali, Raghu Manavalan, Lindsay Foster Thomas, Candice Manriquez. Charlton Thorpe is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rausch. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Carmen Wong Ulrich. Thanks for listening, and let's talk soon. This is APM.